supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
So, what role do the mind and spirit play in how our bodies break down and how they heal? What we know about the mind-body connection has grown tremendously over the last two decades, much of it as a result of work done by my guest on today's show, Dr. Joan Borisenko. She's the author of 11 books, including Minding the Body, Mending the Mind. Her most recent book is called Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? She's co-founder of the Mind-Body Clinic at Harvard, and today we will discuss why she was so inspired to dedicating her life to examining this connection between mind and body and the kind of work she's been doing and who she's been helping and how. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Joan Borisenko, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, when you started working on your PhD at Harvard, what was your vision of your career back then?
Well, you know, when I first set out, my vision was actually that I was going to be some kind of a behavioral neuroscientist, that my greatest interest was really in mind and brain, and I had had a mental illness as a child, and I really wanted to know what goes wrong in the brain that can create mental illness or habit patterns that don't serve us or trains of thought that we'd rather get rid of. And I thought that the combination of, at that time, neuroscience and what was really a kind of new frontier in learning theory, that kind of thing was going to help me get to the bottom of that. So
yeah,
that was my vision.
That really was early on. So what was integrative medicine like, or mind-body medicine? What was that like 20 years ago?
Well, 20 years ago, it was already pretty well developed. But, you know, I've been in this field since 1967, so we're talking about 40 years ago. And it, you know, it wasn't even a bleep on the horizon 40 years ago.
Right.
By 20 years ago, we already had a lot of evidence, particularly in the field known as psychoneuroimmunology. And that is the effect of our beliefs and our behaviors on our body's immune system. And when you recognize, for example, that the immune system is very far-reaching, when you think about, okay, inflammation, even Time magazine had a cover article a couple of years ago on inflammation in the body and how it's responsible really for everything from osteoporosis to frailty in aging, and even to cardiovascular disease. It's like almost a common pathway for almost any chronic illness. And when you recognize that stress increases what are called pro-inflammatory cytokines, an immune factor that is better if it's lower, you recognize, hey, stress and illness are really linked.
All right,
and
so
we did know that 20 years ago. Now we just know the mechanism.
Let me back you up a little bit about the immune system. Tell us about what it is and how it works, and most important, what affects it.
Well, the immune system, in its most basic kind of basic understanding, tells what's you from what's not you. So it protects you. It's like the soldiers at your boundary. And it protects you from being invaded by bacteria or by viruses or by parasites. And then it also protects you from the inside, because our cells are constantly dividing. And every once in a while, there's a mistaken cell division. And you get, for example, a cancer cell, or maybe there are a number of causes of cancer. Everything from environmental toxins to viruses to genetic predispositions that may all interact. But the fact is, the theory is that we're all making cancer cells all the time. And what prevents those cancer cells from growing into actual tumors is our own immune system. that recognizes those and rids the body. So it's guarding us both from the inside and the outside.
So tell us about what thoughts and emotions do to the immune system.
Well, stress depletes the immune system. And many of your listeners have probably heard the word cortisol, which is one of the prime stress-related hormones. And so when you're stressed out and you make cortisol, your body can't make enough immune cells. And also, cortisol prevents the immune cells that you already have from working up to par. So if you're stressed, you're more likely then to catch a cold or to find yourself with a bacterial illness of some sort, maybe pick up strep from the kids. And what we believe is that, you know, you're more likely cancer cells that are in there you can't get rid of so easily.
Well, Joan, we know, though, that cortisol does and did have a function. You know, the stress hormone dumps into our veins when historically there's been a mountain lion, when there's a threat, when our whole body says, we got to get the hell out of here quick.
It's so true, isn't it?
And the problem, though, is that oftentimes now when we get criticism from a boss or we hit too many red lights, our body brains feel like they're all mountain lions.
Well, exactly. And I think particularly people are so stressed in the culture right now, Dan, with, economic problems and very rapid change in information in the world, fear of terrorism, wondering what's going to happen with the global oil supply and wondering if we're going to get our alternative sources of energy up to par. And here's the interesting thing. A little stress is a good thing because it lights a fire under you. And sometimes we're most creative. Like, I love deadlines. That's a little bit of stress. It will get me going. But when the stress load gets too high, that's when we're putting out too much cortisol, too much adrenaline.
Yeah.
And we fall off the edge, and instead of being creative, we get depressed, we get anxious, we get burned out. We find, you know, we can't do what's in front of us.
Yeah,
and what happens is that the body suffers too. There's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which has to do with memory. And people who've been badly stressed for a long time, sometimes like POWs, will have memory problems because cortisol's actually destroyed some of these brain cells.
But let me ask you about our reactivity. Now, if a truck is coming at me, the cortisol's going to dump into my veins, my adrenals are kicking to high gear, and I'm going to get out of the way, hopefully. Now, what's going on in my brain where if I hit too many red lights, I will react the same way?
Well, what happens is this. You start to kindle certain neurons. In other words, they start to fire until there's an old saying in neurosciences that neurons that wire together fire together. So you keep making stronger and stronger pathways. And maybe you start getting a thought pattern, oh boy, every time there's a red light, I'll hit it. I'm late, I'm always late.
So it's essentially a habit of
reactivity. It's a brain habit. You can learn to break that habit. That's the good thing. We're not prisoners of our thoughts, and we're not prisoners of our neural programming. We have the power to change that, reduce our stress, and be much happier and more creative.
In theory, it's
yes.
Easier said than done, but it takes a commitment in practice.
Yes, it does.
I want to get to that. I also want to get to the research Candace Pert is doing that I know you're fond of about emotion. Let me reintroduce you. First, we're talking with Joan Borisenko. She was really on the forefront of the mind-body connection many years ago. Her most recent book is called Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? Our phone number here is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888 877-977-9499. We're talking about how our bodies influence our minds, how our minds influence our bodies, and how to manage the stress we have in our lives. So let's talk about Candace Pert. She's really on the forefront of looking at the molecules of emotion. Tell us about her work and what impact it's had on you.
Oh, well, you know, I've known Candace for many, many years. I think I must have met her right when I was writing Minding the Body, Mending the Mind a good 20 years ago. And Candace was at that time very well known for being the co-discoverer of the binding sites in the brain for endorphins. So we all know we have these pain relievers called endorphins that we make in our own mind. And people with chronic pain will know that, my goodness, if they believe that some pill the doctor gives them is going to relieve that pain, even if the pill is a placebo, the pain will get better. And that's because they release their own pain relievers called endorphins. The reason why endorphins work is because there are receptor sites in various cells of the body for these. So once the brain puts them out, then, you know, it's like Valium or aspirin or any other drug that works. They work because we have receptor sites. And what Candace Pert found subsequent to that is that all of our emotions, we have an emotion, and cells in the limbic system of our brain create molecules. And she calls these neuropeptides, and neuro means brain, a peptide means protein. So the little proteins put out by the brain, like endorphins, and we have binding sites for these various proteins all over our body. So here's the bottom line. If you're happy, these little proteins, kind of happiness juice, goes out of your brain, it goes quickly into your bloodstream, and it binds to receptor sites on all the cells of your body. So you have a happy thought, and suddenly everything in your body responds. In a fraction of a second, everything is changed because of happiness.
Well, I think,
or a sad thought, everything changes. So her deal is that emotions are really the link between the mind and the body.
Thich Nhat Hanh once said that smiling releases endorphins.
Well, it does.
Regardless of how you feel.
Here's the problem. It has to be an actual, real, felt smile, because another researcher, a researcher by the name of Paul Ekman, did that. He found that, all facial expressions release these different endorphins, but there's a difference between a fake smile and a real smile. There are some muscles that a fake smile doesn't touch. And without those, you won't release the good hormones.
Reminds me of the old commercial, you can't fool Mother Nature.
You got it. That's why it's good to laugh. It's good to be around people with a sense of humor.
Yep.
If you like cartoons, go out and get a book of old New Yorker cartoons. Believe me, those smile muscles will get going.
All emotions, in my experience, really are contagious. Sadness, stress, anxiety, joy.
Yes, and the idea is to begin to become less affected by other people's negative emotions, to put up a bit of a screen that keep those away, but to allow yourself to be affected by positive emotions. And the other thing there is, there are people in your life that sometimes you need to let go of, because their effect is not a good one, not a healthful one on you.
You said establish screens so that people with negative emotions don't affect us that much. I trust, Joan, you're not talking about a specific medication here?
No, I'm talking about attitudes, and I'm talking about action. And, you know, it's like people in recovery, one of the first steps that that they have to take is, stop hanging around the people that you've been hanging around with at the bar, for example, your drinking buddies, because they're going to bring you back to that behavior. And I do think that there are people, we all know people, who make us good to feel good. They make us feel great when we're around them. And there are people who are perpetually negative. And you know what? You can't afford to allow yourself to be around perpetually negative people. And if you can't help it, you know, maybe one of them's the mother who lives with you or something like that, then you really need to learn to reframe that in some way. And to reframe means to see something in a different frame of reference and say, well, there's my mother. She's starting with the negativity.
But
the good part about this is that it teaches me to be more positive. How can I do that?
You used a word, and I want to come back to that word and discuss it a little bit before our break, that puts me on alert. Use the word attitude, about changing attitude or having the right attitude. And that can seem like, feel like, an unreasonable challenge. I'm sure we've all had a lot of experience with that. I've had many illnesses in my life, and I'm disabled. And I've had many people tell me that I needed to have a certain kind of attitude, which felt impossible and unreasonable to me.
Well, of course.
How do we change an attitude?
Well, you know, an attitude is an orientation. And it's like the research on optimism and pessimism that Martin Seligman, psychologist who's been called the father of modern psychology,
right,
has been working on for years. And he's not far from you. He's at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he's about a half mile.
Yeah, and so I think he's done a very good job. He says you got to look and say, how do you respond to a difficult situation? Are you an optimist or a pessimist? And optimists and pessimists have what he calls different explanatory styles. They explain why something bad happened in a very different way. And I have to tell you that I come from a family of pessimists.
Yeah, me
all
too.
All of my life I have been pessimistic. The glass is always half empty. I'm always looking for the other shoe to drop. I blame myself for everything. Not anymore, however. Due to Seligman's research, I call myself a recovering pessimist because I've actually learned how does an optimist think? And when I catch myself thinking pessimistically, I think, if I were an optimist, how could I think differently about this? And as you said before, Dan, it's been really hard work. I've been doing that for 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, any meaningful change is hard
work.
Yes,
it's hard work, and I'm not perfect at it, but I'm way happier than I used to be.
See, my parents were both pessimists, too. My father turned cynicism into an art form. He was really good at it.
Should have met my mother.
But I give them both credit for helping me along with my optimism because, you know, I just fought with them all the time about how wrong they were about things. And every time they called me naive, I felt I was on the right track.
Well, see, that was great. And that's reframing a negative circumstance, somebody who wants to pull you down, into an opportunity to do something different. So I'd say you're very good at that. But it doesn't help to tell somebody keep your chin up or think positive. Then you just want to punch them in the face.
Oh, boy, I've heard that so many times, really. I always tell people that unsolicited advice is always self-serving.
It is.
Always.
It is. It's about your own discomfort rather than the needs of the other person.
So let's take a short break, Joan. We're going to come back and talk about what we can do about all of this. And you've done a lot of work with the spirit. I want to know what it is, where you found it, and what it means. My guest is Dr. Joan Borsinko. She has been in the field of mind-body medicine, integrative medicine for many years. She got her doctorate in Harvard, started off looking at the world through microbiology, and now looks at it through just the opposite lens. She's really on the forefront of mind-body medicine. Her best-selling book is Minding the Body, Mending the Mind, and her most recent book is called Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We will get to your calls after this break. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Lansing boils, getting crabs from thrift store pants, and quitting smoking. David Sedaris joins us to talk about his body. His new book is called When You Are Engulfed in Flames. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. My guest is Dr. Joan Borisenko. She's the author of 11 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Minding the Body, Mending the Mind. Her most recent is Your Soul's Compass. I'll get that right one day. Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? And our number is 888-477-9499. Joan, I wanted to talk about matters of soul and spirit in about 10 minutes, but I'm going to go out of order because we've got Andrew on the line, and I'm told that he's a professor and has a class to teach. So,
hello?
We're going to go out of order. Andrew.
Hi.
What time's your class that you have to teach?
12:30, so we should probably move this along a bit, and the students have a test right now. So I'm teaching biology, and one of my most favorite topics to talk about is the impact of the mind over the body and our attitudes. And in addition to all of that kind of science-y talk, I also enjoy talking a lot about religion with my friends. And I myself consider myself an agnostic, but God comes up a lot, spirit comes up a lot, and actually my girlfriend is very involved in yoga and mending her spirit, because she's also overcoming her own mental issues in terms of, you know, positive thoughts and whatnot. So I was just wondering, as a scientist, as a clinician, when you encounter patients or other scientists that are highly skeptical of the concept of the spirit, how do you clinically separate the concept of mind from spirit? I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
We know, for me, spirit is more about behavior than it is about concept. I think our concepts of God have created a lot in the way of holy wars and divisiveness. And the question, for me, is really one about compassion. What leads people to act in a compassionate way? What is it to feel like you're connected with something larger than your own ego's agenda or what you want to get done? And I've been fascinated by these things, as you have, Andrew, for a very long time. And I know that you've got to teach a class, but lately I've had a little bit of help in explaining these things, because at the last few workshops I've given, I've actually shown that video of Bill Bolte Taylor, the neuroanatomist who, when she was at Harvard, had a stroke that brought her left brain off of line. And then she had this experience of tremendous expansiveness, being in touch with something much larger, and a sense of care for all beings, and a great sense of compassion. And it took her 8 years to recover from that stroke, but she's still able to touch that space. And that's a space that I would say is a spiritual space. It's larger than our usual cares and concerns. And it leads us to do good things for other people and good things for ourselves. And that way, that allows people, it doesn't matter whether you believe in God, it doesn't matter whether you're an agnostic, it doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist, it doesn't matter whether you're a scientist, we can all kind of understand that from time to time we touch something that feels larger than ourselves, and it leads us to compassionate action.
So what spirit means is being a part of something larger than we are. It means
something larger and kinder.
It means that our ego is quiet. It means what I believe in deeply, that ultimately who we are is not all that important, and what we do is terribly important.
I would say that's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody tells me they're a spiritual person and then engages in a tremendous amount of bad judgment against themselves. I mean, conscience is important. We have to have it. But, you know, you learn what you learn, and then you go on. If you're constantly stuck in judgment of yourself or others, if, God forbid, you know, like one of those dictators of a one of the countries in Africa, you believe in the Ten Commandments and you try to advance that by murdering, raping, and killing, it tells me there's not much spirituality there. It really is, as you say, Dan, a matter of your action. And that's so important.
Stephen Post, runs the Center for the Study of Altruistic Love at Case Western Reserve.
Isn't that marvelous?
Yeah, that's a pretty cool job. But he defines love as love for all humanity without exception, with abiding kindness and service. And to me, that kind of selfless state of being is a deeply spiritual. It is being love. It is not loving or being in love.
Yes, exactly. Just as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, it's being love.
Yeah.
And that actually is what led us. Just the kind of thing that you're talking about, a deep inquiry of that, fascination with that, led my husband, Gordon DeVerin, and I to write our latest book, which is the one, Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? Because, you know, we kept thinking, my goodness, we're coming up on an election year. How often do you hear political leaders, you know, whether in this country or, you know, some leader who says, I'm going to advance the Ten Commandments by killing everyone.
Yeah.
How often do you hear people say, I'm following spiritual guidance? And you realize, what's spiritual guidance? It's the agenda of their own ego.
Well, yeah, I want to hear about that. Let's say goodbye to Andrew. Andrew, I hope you got your answer. I don't know if you had to go to teach your course, but one thing Joan said and I said, it was about compassion for things outside of yourself, tender, loving compassion for things outside of yourself. So being concrete, I think you should probably give all your students an A on this exam, and you'll feel better about yourself.
So you bring up something so interesting, Dan. What is the difference between compassion and codependence? You can't enable those students for not studying.
Oh, I don't want to touch that. Come on. God, you're so strict. So tell us about the soul's compass. What is spiritual guidance?
Well, this was what we set out to look at. And so we're very interested because we're, you know, as you already get the sense, we don't conflate religion with spirituality. That religions, we believe, exist because they're trying to bring people to the spiritual. But the spiritual is not necessarily the same as religion. And sometimes religion works very well, bringing people to the spiritual. And sometimes it fails terribly.
Historically, religion had another purpose, too. And that was, well, community, of course, but to give people guidance.
Absolutely. And that was
external.
When, you know, I run a school called Claritas, which is the Latin word for clarity or illumination. And it was based on, you know, the desert mothers and fathers in the second century. People used to come out to the desert and say, look, help me find my way spiritually. I don't know what I'm doing. Give me a word. Give me a phrase. You know,
right.
Tell me, am I on the right track? Am I getting closer to living a spiritual life, or am I going further away? And ideally, that's what spiritual guidance is. And Catholics understand that because they have a tradition called spiritual direction. Buddhists understand that because in the Buddhist tradition, you avail yourself of what's called a kalyanamitta. It comes from the Pali word metta, or loving kindness. It means the beautiful friend who loves you, will sit with you and reflect back what you tell them about your life, so that, you know, they can give you a little bit of help figuring out, am I going closer to the spiritual, or, you know, am I getting lost in other people's opinions, social construct,
you know,
the leftovers from my past.
Joan, you talked about the Buddhist and you talked about Catholic. What comes to mind is in the Hebrew Bible, the words where God tells Abraham to leave his father's house. The literal words are lech lecha, and the general translation for that is leave your father's house. But a rabbi friend of mine tells me that the literal translation of those words are leave what is familiar.
Yes.
And that's the beginning of the journey, and that's really what sitting meditation is, really. It's the beginning of leaving what's familiar.
It's leaving what's familiar, and that, you know, that's so important. And by the way, I don't know if you know the music of Debbie Friedman. But
yes.
Yes, she has a beautiful rendition of Lech Lecha.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
So what we did for Your Soul's Compass was to interview 27, we call them the sages, lineage holders, from different traditions. So a male and a female rabbi, a male and a female Catholic, not a male and a female Catholic priest,
good luck with
a male priest and a couple of female Episcopal priests, Sufis and Buddhists and Hindus and shamans. And what you just said was what they all said, the precondition for guidance is to know that you don't know, to enter that phase of unknowing where you're open to see, but you're out of the box of what you believe, because otherwise you'll never see anything but the inside of the box. And just as you said, well, that's what meditation is about. It is an invitation outside the box to say, I don't know everything, but I'm willing to be mindful, I'm willing to be attentive, I'm willing to be curious, I'm willing to be shown, then you open yourself to a world that is so much more interesting, so much richer.
Joan,
yes.
I am a quadriplegic, have been for almost 30 years.
Amazing.
And in my clinical practice as a psychologist, of course, I've worked with a lot of people who've had cancer and trauma and similar trauma to me, that all of a sudden, in a flash, your life's changed. There's, you're walking down the street and there's no sidewalk underneath you and you're in free fall. It's not an unusual experience. But this is exactly what we're talking about. I haven't chosen to leave what's familiar. What was familiar was stolen from me.
Yes, that's right.
And in that moment, and people report this to me every day, and I know you've heard it, in that moment, there's a quality of clarity, of truth, of knowing, of safety in a bizarre way. There's nothing good about what happened to me or when you get cancer. But in that moment, when you lose everything you had before, all of a sudden, you know what's important in the world, and you know what's not, and you have the courage and clarity to devote your life to what is important.
Well, that's right. That's actually why we call our school Claritas. It's precisely that. And the question, I think, it's a question I don't really have an answer for, Dan. It's an ongoing inquiry, is how can we devote ourselves to developing that kind of clarity that can come in different ways and often does accompany a really difficult experience?
See,
can we develop that?
I would take exactly that question and eliminate the word how.
Mm-hmm.
Can we devote ourselves to developing this? Can we devote ourselves to going further? That's a yes or no answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, from my personal life experience, that's the more important question.
It is. And here's the thing, you know, when people talk about mind-body medicine, often what they want is 10 steps to perfect healing. And, you know, the most important step is simply being open and curious in this way,
yeah,
devoting yourself to what we might consider other ways of knowing. So to recognize we don't know everything, but we are open, we are willing, and in the end to recognize, I think, in the spiritual sense, for me, the question I'm always asking is, where is the vector of love moving? In any situation, what expands the situation? What opens the situation? What creates, unmasks more potentials or opportunities in the situation? They're not answers, they're questions,
right.
They're inquiries.
Well, you know what Einstein's famous quote is, you know, cherish the questions because the answers change anyway.
Exactly.
Let me tell our audience we're talking with Joan Borisenko. She's the author of 11 books, including Minding the Body, Mending the Mind. She's the co-founder of the Mind Body Clinic at Harvard. She and her husband have established Claritas, as she explained, and her new book is called Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? We're going to go to the phones right after our break. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. Just as we're a partner in cardiac surgery with Cleveland Clinic, we want our patients to be partners in care with us. To help you get the facts you need, our website now features important information about quality of care, patient satisfaction, and more. Located in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and online at 866drheart.com, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital. Beyond good care.
Next time on Day to Day,
film director Roman Polanski, desired by movie studios
and wanted by the law.
The director fled the country in 1978 to avoid prison.
He was convicted of having sex with a 13-year-old girl.
Everyone thinks they know what happened. I don't think anyone other than the two of them know what really happened.
A new documentary tries to sort out the story.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're with Joan Borisenko, internationally renowned expert on mind-body connection and so much more, author of many books. Her most recent is Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? It's published by Hay House. Yes, Joan?
That's right.
So let's go right to the phones, as promised. We'll start with Susan. Susan, hi, you're on Voices. Susan, do we have you? I guess we have a technical problem. We'll go to the phones in a second. You talk a great deal about mindfulness, of course, and how we need to be mindful. One of the chapters in your book, your original book, is about mindfulness and the discovery of self. So I'd like to hear about both. Tell us about mindfulness and its effect on stress, and then tell us about this business of self.
Okay. First of all, let me tell you a story. This was World War II. They were recruiting people for the intelligence agency, and the test was this. You sat in the waiting room, you went in for your interview, and you were asked to describe everything that was in the waiting room, what was around you. So in other words, were you observant, were you curious, and did you notice? And by the way, it was a Navajo who did the best on that test, because in that particular culture, you had to be mindful of the world around you, mindful of the animals, mindful of the light, mindful of everything. And in modern culture, we're often not so mindful. We're mindful of what we're thinking. We're stuck inside of our own head, and it can be cold or hot or beautiful, and we're not in relationship with the world around us. So mindfulness is that kind of curious relationship where we're really aware, we're awake to the outer world as well as our own inner world. And what we understand is that you know, if you want a good definition in a certain sense of love, it requires that kind of mindfulness. You have to notice, you have to engage with, it's like Martin Buber, it's the I-thou relationship instead of the I-it. You're relating to a thing. It's like, you know, it's like that old metaphor, is life a menu or is it the meal? You have to be mindful enough that you're really in relation. So that's what mindfulness is
about. All right, so let me be devil's advocate here.
Sure.
You're asking me to be mindful, to be awake to my internal and my external life. And for the moment, my life is in the toilet. I'm under great stress and job problems, and I can't sleep, and I'm just a miserable guy. And so where's the payoff in being mindful for that?
Well, the payoff is that if you're mindful that the moon is also rising, that day it is earlier was sunny and was beautiful, then you're also capable of seeing everything around you for which you can be grateful, and it brings you more into the present moment. What mindfulness ultimately teaches you is that your current misery, a lot of it takes place in your mind, and that everything changes moment by moment by moment. So it teaches you more to be in the moment, not to be stuck in the past or stuck in the worries of the future, but more to just be with what is. And
yeah.
What is constantly changing. And yes, you know, I know you well enough, Dan, to say, well, that's a tall order, that's hard. And it really is.
Right.
It is difficult. And that's why it's called a practice, because it's like practicing the piano. You don't get any better at it.
Yeah, it's like one of my first meditation teachers said, you know, I mean, basically what we're doing is we're asking people to sit with their minds. And, you know, my first teacher said, you know, the mind can be a dangerous place to go. You never want to go in that neighborhood by yourself.
But, you know, in terms of having been then, obviously, a meditator for a long time yourself, that you do, after a while, recognize, my goodness, my mind never shuts up. It's thinking, 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 thinking. But there's another part of me that's able to notice, oh, my mind is thinking. And in the words of Father Thomas Keating, he brought something called contemplative prayer back into Catholicism, and it really has spread throughout many of the Christian churches. Not just Catholic, but Protestant too. He says, you know, your thoughts are like boats that float along the river. But essentially, if you can start to pay attention to the river instead of the boat, then you're in touch with a deeper flow.
Yeah.
And that particular flow is extraordinarily clear, peaceful, present, feels really good.
And to do that takes practice.
Yeah.
And the practice itself, you know, early on in the show, Joan, you talked about neural pathways. And my experience is the practice itself lays down new neural pathways. Every time your mind goes haywire while you're practicing, every time you bring it back to your breath or to whatever you're attending to, every time you bring it back, you're practicing laying new neural pathways to be unattached to all the flotsam and jetsam that's in our minds.
Exactly. I think of it as a kind of meditation. It's like a mental martial arts. And you think of martial artists, they're in their center. They're not constantly distracted and pulled away by this thought or that thought. They're in their center.
Right. Good luck.
And there's such a nobility and grace in that. That's how I'd like to live my life.
I was going to say, I have visited that neighborhood for milliseconds at a time.
Yes, milliseconds at a time. But, you know, even the milliseconds, it's so exciting.
They're good.
It's possible.
They're good.
This is possible. And, you know, Mahai Csikszentmihalyi might call that the flow state.
That's right. That's right.
And we have different words for that. Sometimes people call it, well, you know, I've just touched something, they would think, really real. This feels real. This is my true self, not the part of me that's always worried and hassled and anguished and thinking. And
yep.
So when I say, you know, the self, the rediscovery of the self, I mean, what is most real and vital within us as human beings?
It is the stuff probably underneath the self. I've been promising our callers we'd let them in on the conversation. So let's
that'll be great, but I'm having so much fun talking with you. What a privilege this is.
And I am to you. Thank you. Let's have Susan join us. Susan, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for a wonderful discussion. If one has been under very high stress for several years, do we know how long it takes to reduce the cortisol level? And can you reverse the effects of the cortisol?
Yes, you can. And, you know, that's the good thing. What we've been talking about is that the nervous system, first of all, has got plasticity. So, yes, you can reduce the effects of the cortisol. And my sense is that you can, and not my sense, scientifically, it takes a millisecond to turn off the cortisol. You just have to start thinking differently.
It's
harder to turn off the attitude that turns the spigot back on again.
And I would suggest, Susan, that your question, how long does it take, is a stressful question.
Yes.
I mean, that question puts stress on you.
Yes.
It takes what it takes, and you know, the attitude that Joan talked about is almost an attitude, in my mind, of compassion for you. And that begins now, genuinely caring for the person you are, for the body that you have that's hurting right now. I mean, cortisol causes unfelt pain. Your body's in pain. And it starts with feeling compassion for the pain in your body that you can't feel right now. And how long does it take? It takes a lifetime.
Right, the process.
Yeah, yeah. It does get easier. It does get better. It does get more rewarding, but God knows not in a linear fashion. You agree, Joan?
Well, I do. And, you know, there are always people, it's quite amazing, who have a sudden change of mind or heart. The Greeks would call that a metanoia. Everything changes. But for most of us, the change is slow, and it depends on, of course, what your circumstance is, Susan. So I can't really talk to that in any authentic way without sitting and talking to you for quite a long time to find out who you are and what the situation has been. But what I can say is this, that change is possible because it's the stuff of life. Everything's always changing. And I can certainly say that what Dan said is so important. You just have to start by being compassionate for yourself. And that means allowing change to happen slowly, doing the things you need to do to nurture yourself, to care for yourself. And little by little, it will change.
I wonder your thoughts about another factor, Joan, that I add, and that's about this business of faith. And I believe it's important to have faith that our bodies will heal themselves if we let them.
Yes, it's so true. You know, years ago, a little personal story, years ago, I was in a very, very bad car crash. And pretty well lost my nose, got bashed against the steering wheel. And there I am in the emergency room, and I've asked to be taken to the hospital where I worked and had a plastic surgeon called that I knew well. And as he was preparing to, you know, start surgery, he said, you do mind-body medicine, but I need to make sure that you understand this one thing, and that is it's the nature of your body to heal. That you don't have to instruct it. Your body knows how to heal. And the only job you have is to stay out of the way and not impede that process. So he looked and he said, do you know how to stay out of the way? And by now, it was kind of like being in the dentist chair. I'm anesthetized, and he's sewing my nose back onto my face. And he's giving me this monologue. He says, it's calling your boss and telling your boss, you won't be there for a month and not to bother you at home. Your body has things to do. It needs to do that. It's telling your husband that you're not going to be doing the dishes. It's telling your kids that this is your time to heal. And he said, probably what you've done is given your whole life to other people. And what you really need to do now in this healing process is simply rest. And rest allows your body to do what it does.
You know, I use physiologic images often when talking about the spirit and the soul. You know, you cut your arm and it's going to heal itself. All we have to do is keep the environment clean. And that's our only job, is not to heal it, but to keep the environment clean so that it can heal itself. Joan, I want to thank you so much for joining us. This has been delightful.
Totally delightful, Dan. I just loved it. And thank you so much for having me as your guest.
As did I. And thank you so much. On behalf of the larger community, thank you for the work you do.
Well, you're very welcome, and I'm excited to be there this next time.
Yeah,
next
you're going to be around the corner. I'm going to introduce that in just about 2 seconds. My guest today has been Dr. Joan Borisenko. She's an internationally renowned expert on the mind-body connection. She's authored over 11 books, including her most recent, Your Soul's Compass, What is Spiritual Guidance? For more information, visit www.joanborisenko.com. She's going to be appearing on June 14th in Cherry Hill. Call 856-470-1399. Again, that's 856-470-1399. There's going to be a free panel discussion on the topic of adoption this Thursday night. Please visit us at whyy.org to find more information about that. Well, if you've got a question or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org, or you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.